Welcome, students, to Humanities 2. We're looking at modern Europe and the time period that we've called ruin. Today's topic is World War II. Some veterans of World War II are still with us. My grandpa served in the Philippines late in the war. He's now 92, though. And so those who served in that war, the veterans, are getting fewer and fewer. But they're still around, and so you can actually ask maybe a relative, like as I have my grandpa, or you know, in your family, just what their experience of World War II was like, and or maybe not serving in the war, but just having lived through it as a child. What was it like? What was their memory? It is the most destructive war in history in terms of casualties. We saw that millions died in World War I to such an extent that they called it the Great War. Well, World War II had 50 million. If World War I extended into, you know, the Middle East, World War II circles the globe. One of the theaters is the Pacific Ocean. When it is all done in 1945, after 6 years of conflict, there is $13 billion in damage, and I'm assuming that's in dollars then. Whole countries basically were decimated. Large-scale destruction. In Japan, it ended with the dropping of the world's first use of atomic weapons or nuclear weapons with the atomic bombs. And so this is a catastrophe on large scale. One thing that makes it really interesting and different than World War I is there's clearly a bad guy, or more than one bad guy. In World War I, it's like, why are they even fighting other than pride, as we talked about? But in World War II, you have Adolf Hitler, who we'll read about next week, very likely demon-possessed. But you also have the aggression of Japanese imperialism in the East as they colonize and oppress peoples like on the Korean Peninsula, I believe, and in China and other places. And so stopping these very aggressive, oppressive nations became a target or a goal of World War II. Fascist aggression and atrocities, we'll call it. Well, let's just lay out then the two sides of the war so you understand. On the one hand, if we look at the so-called the bad guys, and I believe they are bad, this is the Axis. You have in Germany Adolf Hitler and the Third Reich. That wording comes from being the third German Empire, going back to Charlemagne, going back to then the Kaiser, which means Caesar. When Germany is unified in the late 1800s, what was fought under World War I, now he's going to start a new kingdom again and get rid of the Weimar Republic and democracy. Of course, he's the dictator. In Italy, you have Benito Mussolini, who has been a dictator since the 1920s, I believe. One thing I heard about him is that he got rid of, I think, maybe two-thirds of the saint days, like Saint So-and-So Day, in order to improve the productivity of the Italians. They had too many holidays, literally saint days. And then Japan, the Emperor Hirohito, I put him down in the notes, but it's basically it's a militaristic state, and the lords or the generals are in control of society, and the emperor, though he's respected and revered and I suppose treated as a god, as divine in some sense, is not as much in key control. It's not like a Roman emperor. Okay, so you have Germany and Italy who are then in Europe in treaty, and then they also are in alliance with Japan, though Japan's on the other side of the world. The Allies are Britain, the United States, and the USSR. I say so-called good side, not just because the USSR is there, the communists, the Russians, though Joseph Stalin is a horrible individual, and how he killed so many in his five-year plans and collectivistic statist imposition of power. It's awful. But America, I mean, what nation is good? We have our own sins. We have our own black eyes in history. And so when I say good, it's a relative term when it comes to history, just as much as when it comes to people. If you use it in an absolute sense, you're going to be with Jesus saying there is none good but God alone. There's only one kingdom that is truly a good kingdom, and that's the kingdom of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. But on a relativistic basis, I think World War II will qualify as a just war. There are crimes being committed in the Nazi regime, as we'll look at the Holocaust. There's no joke. I mean, no lie. So some want to deny it. 6 million Jews, as well as others. And so very much, these are evil empires, as Ronald Reagan famously called the Russians in the early 80s. So, yeah, Britain and America and Russia. Now, I mentioned Russia has Joseph Stalin as their leader. America has FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who's been president since 1933. He's the longest person in the presidency, as far as longest presidency. He was voted in for a fourth term. After this, the Constitution was changed. President can only serve two terms. There's term limits. He actually dies in office before the war ends, and his vice president, Harry Truman, becomes president and is also in a narrow victory than president afterwards in the post-war era. In Britain, you have a great leader, Winston Churchill. I'm not sure that he knew the Lord Jesus Christ, but he's a principled man. His politics, as far as social politics, he's progressive in some sense, and he would actually go back and forth a little on the Liberal Party or the conservative side of things. But when it came to the war, wise leader, and probably one of the best statesmen of the 20th century, which is why I'm having you read a book about him. I think you'll find him fascinating, and so as part of your homework. Churchill and Roosevelt had met before America came into the war with Pearl Harbor. They had actually met in a ship in the North Atlantic in 1940, I believe, conversing together of how they would work together as nations. And so America and Great Britain were very close, speaking the same language, other than the dialect difference, which I understand is a fourth of the words. But speaking the same language, very close. The odd fellow out, and I mean odd, is the Russians, because they're communists. I'm going to talk about that in just a second. France, if you remember, in World War I, France was with Great Britain against the Germans. It's kind of a repeating. Some have even called World War II kind of the last battle of World War I. But France is nowhere to be found here other than the resistance, because France is defeated early in the war by Germany, and they set up a puppet government, the Vichy government in France, and that lasts through the duration of the war, basically. And so they're not a player. I mentioned a couple generals that you should be aware of. Dwight Eisenhower, who later becomes president. George Patton, very eccentric general. Comes from North Africa into Italy, and then heads one of the big armies into Germany to end the war. I believe he thought he was a reincarnation of like a Roman general. I did get confirmed knowledge, that little knowledge I have, that he used to carry around ivory handled pistols and carried one of those with him. And so an interesting general. In the Pacific Ocean, a general is in the army, right? In the Pacific Ocean area, you have the army out there actually going on land in areas under Douglas MacArthur, a very famous general in American history. He's later in the Korean conflict, where he wants to push beyond what the United Nations, I think, is describing as the kind of line, the demilitarization area and such. He wants to push beyond it and take care of the communists in North Korea. He gets relieved of his duties by President Truman for insubordination, apparently. And so that's a big incident in American military history, how this hero of World War II, Japanese actually surrendered him on the USS Missouri in 1945. He presides over that. This hero of World War II, just a handful of years later, gets taken out of his post. Well, there's admirals and others, Admiral Nimitz and different ones, but these ones I would want you to remember. Now, let's go back to the idea that there are moral sides. It's a relative term, good and bad. It's not absolute, like we mentioned, but there's definitely a moral difference between them. A very good historian of both ancient military and modern military is Victor Davis Hanson, who sometimes speaks and teaches at Hillsdale College. In his online course, he summarizes World War II in terms of two competing arguments regarding the nature of man. One argument views man primarily as part of a group, a collective. In other words, the individual is less important than the group. And that this collective is shaped in decisive respects by race or class. So in the communists, you have class. They view everything in terms of the capitalist factory owner class who get rich off the backs of the laborers, the farmers, and the machinists, the factory workers. And so there's class conflict between the rich and the poor, typically in a communist or Marxist setting. Or race. Well, that's the Hitler's view, right? The Aryan race. Classical schools, classical Christian schools sometimes have students read Mein Kampf by Hitler. And I was going to do that, and I started reading it myself, and it's so bad. It's like so satanic in its statements about the Jews. That I was like, there is no way I'm going to let a high school student sit down with Adolf Hitler and just read him for a while. Like, this is awful. But it is so racist. The Jews are a scapegoat in his view. They're the problem, the source of the problem. We need to get rid of the Jews and develop this pure lineage of Aryan race kind of thing. And the so-called blue-eyed, blonde-haired Northern European. Well, that's on the one side. The other side, Hanson says that view, that collectivist view, led to the invasion of peaceful lands and the organized slaughter of millions in the Holocaust and elsewhere. The other argument views the human soul as free, never to be governed without consent. And I think there's some qualifications that need to be on this. Otherwise, we end up with an extreme that was in Rousseau in the Enlightenment, as if man's born free and yet ignoring the fact he's born a baby and he doesn't have obligations to honor his father for life and such. It's not a mere individual, but yet the individual soul, something valued by Christianity, making its own decisions before God, if at all possible, where the founders saw religion as supporting morality so that morality would support liberty, which would then bless religion as well. But that scale of religion to morality to liberty, where self-government through religion, and I would say through genuine Christianity, belief in Christ, then enables a person to freely do what is right without having to be told to do what is right. That view was on the other side. Eisenhower actually then urged, right before D-Day, urged the troops, this is for your way of life. Now, that's not just selfishly describing it. This is for freedom, which the world was teetering, as it were, between freedom and slavery at this point, between the individualistic, individual right-affirming societies and the collectivist societies. Let me just give you a little story so you don't think I'm just making something up. Next year, you're going to read the story of Flyboys, which is the story of the pilots in World War II out in the Pacific. And just to let you know, we'll focus more today on Europe. More in our studies of modern Europe, we'll focus on Europe, less on what happens in the Pacific, and less on America. During Humanities 2, World War II, the focus is on modern Europe. Next year, when we do American History and Lit, then we'll get to focus more upon America's entrance into the war and the Pacific as well. And so one of the books that I have you read next year is called Flyboys. And in there is a mission of 9 planes, I believe, to Chichijima, another one of the islands like Iwo Jima, to take out, I think, a radio tower or two. And 8 of the planes are shot down, and those men are captured. One of the planes, I believe, makes it out into sea and is also damaged. The pilot ejects, lands in the ocean. And as the Japanese, if I remember right, are starting to go out to go get the guy, a U.S. submarine surfaces and takes this flyboy, this pilot, into their care, and he survives. That pilot happens to be George Bush Sr., President of the United States after Ronald Reagan. He was that pilot that survived, and when he returned to that site in about year 2000, after he had been president, and was standing there looking over the ocean where he had dropped in, and a Japanese veteran of World War II who had also been there was present with him that day. The comment, I believe, was made that the Japanese would have never sent a submarine after one pilot or soldier or sailor. That individualistic care is the legacy of Christianity, where each soul is valued. We're losing that in our culture now. But this is part of the heritage of Christ in the West, that we would value one of the sheep, like in Jesus' parables, leave the 99 and find that one sheep, which referred to one soul. And how there's joy in heaven over one soul that repents. Well, it's that vision then for society that the West or the Allies then are going to fight for. And in the East, in the other side, the Axis is not. Now, the odd duck out is the odd one. It's called Strange Bedfellow because in the colonial era, if you visited homes, you might be put in a bed to sleep the night with a complete stranger. And so those, like, that's the name where two complete strangers might end up just kind of like sleeping the night, getting refreshed. Obviously, nothing sensual going on. It's not like that. And so the communist nation, being with two democracies, the limited monarchy of England and the Republic of America, is so strange. And you see, after the war, the two sides totally are opposed, and the Cold War begins, something we'll talk about later in this course. So Germany and Italy are fascist. Russia is communist. And Hitler hated the communists. But the odd thing is, they're both socialist. They're both collectivist. The individual's not important. And in a socialist society, the government owns businesses. And so Hitler starts Volkswagen, the people's car, that kind of thing, to make vehicles. And that's what I'm told. And so they're both socialists. The difference is a fascist is also nationalistic, patriotic, we would say. Communists, it's the world they're going after. Workers of the world, unite. And so the communists are big picture, global in orientation, where the fascists are very much nationalistic. And so the Italians and the Germans are fascist socialists. The Russians are communist socialists. The Germans and the Japanese, interesting, are both racist. Not only are they nationalistic, but they also believe that their bloodlines are superior, they're a superior breed of humans. The Aryans in Germany, but the Japanese look on the Chinese, for example, as second class, maybe even subhuman, if I remember right, and treat them horribly. And so those nations are not only lacking in individual liberty, but they also have a superiority complex, thinking they're a superior race. Well, I hope this helps explain the sides and how different this is than World War I. Well, okay, let's go through the history of the war, and I'm going to have you read Stephen Ambrose's picture book on it. Lots of facts, really neat illustrations. He's a World War II scholar. And then I'm also having you read the book on Winston Churchill, lots of facts through his life as well. But like I said, it's the last battle of World War I. The Treaty of Versailles did not settle things. The lines were drawn arbitrarily. Democracies were imposed upon a people that did not have the mindset for them. And Germany in particular was blamed as being the cause of the war, was fined with war reparations that they needed to repay. So they're now deep in debt. And they were kept from creating a military. And so you can't create a military. And then they also were forced into a democratic straitjacket with the Weimar Republic. Deep resentments were given to the German people through this treatment. And I'm not saying that they weren't guilty. I think all sides were guilty in World War I and should have confessed their sins. And I don't know how that should have been resolved then. I'm not a political theorist and a foreign policy advisor. May God bless those who have such counsel. That's a hard job. But at this point, it's a historical fact that the way Germany was treated set things up for World War II. It's not long after. I mean, if November 11th, 1918 is the end of World War I, at the 11th hour, the 11th day of the 11th month, well, it's a mere 21, not even 21 years later, just over 20 years later, World War II begins. That is short. Very little time between the one to the other. And so here are the steps that lead to World War II. Victor Davis Hanson identifies three causes, and we talked about causes of World War I. Well, here are some causes. We call them factors. One is British appeasement. Britain, under, say, Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain, was unwilling to hold Hitler accountable. Hitler started gobbling up little states here and there, the Sudetenland, and then annexing Austria, and then claiming, well, the reason why we're annexing these areas is that they speak German and we're uniting all the German-speaking peoples. But Winston Churchill saw this is a man that whose lust for power is not going to be satisfied with just treaties. He can't be trusted. And it's interesting that the Russians fall prey to this. Hitler makes a pact with the Russians secretly that if I go in and invade Poland, you will not then defend Poland. And this opens up the door for his entrance into Poland. Later, Hitler's going to betray the Russians and actually enter into the Soviet Union and invade them. In 41, excuse me. And so Hitler cannot be trusted, not even by the Russians. He is thirsty for power. And so nobody's listening. Apparently, very few, if any, are listening to Winston Churchill before the war breaks out. Of course, he becomes prime minister in the war, I might say, thankfully. And so the Russian collusion then is part of the start of the war. I'm assuming that's what Hansen refers to, the secret pact with Germany. And the other is American isolationism. America had saved the day, as it were, in World War One, and has no interest now in you know, solving the affairs of Europe. Let Europe solve their own affairs. They've been fighting each other for centuries, and who could ever solve this? Maybe those are part of the arguments then. But it took the attack on Pearl Harbor to convince the American public, the American Congress, to declare war. Some probably already convinced of that, as we talked about FDR already working with Churchill about, you know, supplies and how to help the war effort. So these three causes, British appeasement, American isolationism, and Russian collusion, set up the stage for German aggression, going after more and more lands, and the expansion of Nazi Germany. I have in your notes Neville Chamberlain's tragic statement when he said, "We have peace in our times." He came back from a meeting in Munich with Hitler, saying, "This is the second time a prime minister has gone to Germany, spoken with the Germans, and we have secured this treaty." And I think he tells the British people, "You can sleep well tonight." And so sometimes it's hard. As a leader, you want to say words that puts people's fears at ease. It is hard to tell people the truth about you're dying, or your children are rebellious, or you're sinning, or whatever the hard truth is. But the Bible says, better is open rebuke than love that is concealed. Now, you don't want to just say hard words because you don't love people. But if you love somebody, speak the hard words. Seek the right occasion. Seek the right tone. Faithful are the wounds of a friend. Again, someone who loves you. Faithful are the wounds of a friend. Deceitful are the kisses of an enemy. And so speak the truth to people. We need to learn to do that. And it's not easy. And thankfully, Churchill was speaking the truth. And maybe set him up then to be a strong leader in that era. So, the steps then that lead to the war, I mentioned the German annexations, the militarization, Hitler starts building up the military, the secret agreement with Russia. Also, Japan starts invading Korea, China. Eventually, they take over the Philippines and are in New Guinea and island after island and are just creating an empire in the Pacific. A ruler of rulers. Well, here's the overview of the war. You should be familiar with these things. These things are, they should not be forgotten. The war begins in Europe with the Blitzkrieg into Poland. Blitz is lightning, Krieg is war. It's a lightning war. It's fast. They move into Poland quickly. There's 3 million Jews from the Ashkenazi Jewish society. 3 million Jews that are in Poland. All of them now are under Nazi control and are in jeopardy of their lives, as they will soon find out. The Germans also quickly move west into France. And as in World War One, the British come over to check them and to help the French. But unlike World War One, there's no checking the Nazis. By June of 1940, Paris has fallen and France is theirs. And right before that time, Britain's army is in danger in the northern part of France at Dunkirk. Maybe you saw the movie that recently came out about this. But over the span of 9 days, the largest, I believe, evacuation of troops in the history of the world occurred in bringing them over back to England. A mere number of miles, 27 nautical miles, I believe, back to England. The sad thing about it is that's the miracle about it is, like, why didn't the Nazis come in and attack them? They attacked them with planes, and during this whole summer, the confidence, the overconfidence in the Luftwaffe, the Air Force, is fueling the Nazi kind of agenda rather than invasions and using land troops where Britain was vulnerable. And so I'm told that they had to wait. Some soldiers would wait in waist-deep water for hours, like waiting for a bus, one said, before the ships would show up. And many of the commercial vessels had been commandeered for this evacuation of troops. Churchill was thankful for the so-called miracle, but he said, "We must be very careful not to assign to this deliverance the attributes of a victory. Wars are not won by evacuations." And indeed, one article I read said the Allies left behind over 2,000 cannons, around 65,000 vehicles, 20,000 motorcycles, 377,000 tons of supplies, and 68,000 tons of munitions, and 147,000 tons of fuel. I mean, their lives were saved, but the Nazis got a lot of supplies because of the evacuation. Well, at this point, the Allies are not doing well. The Americans aren't in the war, right? This is 1940. London is being bombed all summer. This is the basis of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Children are sent out of London to safety out in the country. And then the Nazis invade Russia and double deal with the Russians in 1941, which is very stupid, I believe, because now they've created two fronts. They had their back covered with their agreement with Russia. Poland was secured, and they could focus on the Allies to the west, or Britain alone, for most of that time period. But now they brought the Russians against them. And then, of course, late in 1941, the Americans are going to join as well to form the Allies. And so now Germany is going to be strapped by the end of the war looking for bodies again, men to just occupy positions. So this is how the war begins. Germany is definitely making progress. In the Pacific Ocean, we talked about the imperialism of Japan invading various places, the attack of Pearl Harbor on early Sunday morning, a surprise attack. Whether it was known or not ahead of time, I think, is a debated historical point. But it definitely, it is a solemn place, I am told. I've never been there. But to go out to the middle of the harbor, where a memorial for the USS Arizona is, which was most of our fleet, Pacific fleet, was sunk, or at least damaged, right in harbor, never made it out of harbor. And to realize that those in the USS Arizona were basically encapsulated in a tomb, right at the bottom of the harbor. I'm told that people don't talk. It's a solemn place to remember a tragic event. War is tragic. Jesus will someday get rid of war. There's an old saying in Latin that war is sweet to the inexperienced. It's kind of like makes for fun movies. But if you see the kind of traumatic stress syndrome kind of stuff that veterans suffer from. And I have a friend of mine who talked about his father being broken by World War II. And the battles that he fought, even the Battle of the Bulge. This is hard stuff. And as Sherman said regarding the Civil War, war is hell. And I don't believe it's as hard as the true hell is. But it is definitely a wrath, part of God's wrath on this world. A general wrath. Well, at this time period of America's history, the Philippines actually belonged to us. It's one of our only colonized areas in Asia. It's given its freedom in 1947 to be an independent nation, but it was given to us by Spain in 1898, I believe, through the Spanish-American War, which we defeated Spain. And so when the Philippines are also attacked, Americans were there to defend it, but were pushed off the island. And Douglas MacArthur famously said, "I shall return," which that's in the hands of God, Lord willing, after that would be appropriate. But the soldiers that are captured have formed, they were so mistreated. The Japanese practiced cannibalism, we found out, under classified documents that were released 50 years later, as well as all sorts of atrocities on the death march, and it's some, when we're talking about the atrocities and aggressiveness of the Axis, we're not making things up. So, Victor Davis Hanson said, regarding the tactics of the war, what things could be learned? Well, in Europe, what was learned is the air power was overestimated. I suppose you could learn that from Hitler's just trying to bomb them out rather than send the troops. Ground operations were still the key to secure victory and became the key in the end, though the Allies learned how to manage their air power well, apparently. In the Pacific Ocean, as well as probably in Europe, but especially Pacific, there was an overestimation of battleships, where it was found out that having a flexible fleet around the aircraft carriers was the key here to military victory. And of course, the battle, Ecclesiastes says, not in to the strong, and the race is not always to the swift. God alone controls these things, but factors are factors, and normally, under normal providence, those factors win out. And so you make your plans based on the factors, and then you commit your plans to the Lord, who alone is sovereign and rules these things. The goal on both sides was to destroy industrial capacity, the ability to make guns, munitions, tanks, yada yada, as well as to finally occupy the enemy's capital. And of course, the Allies converge on Berlin and eventually take it over and divide it out among the Allied powers, as well as the dividing Germany. And what starts the Cold War is the Russians don't relinquish their power and then establish communism. Now, the turning points of the war are pretty clear. In Europe, it's D-Day, Operation Overlord, the greatest land invasion, I'm told, in history, coming from the sea, I suppose, where over 156,000 troops are given, landing on the beaches of Normandy. And your book by Stephen Ambrose is going to have pictures about this. Look at the number of troops that are landing. They are attacking Fortress Europe. Adolf Hitler and the Nazis have fortified the edge, the rim of Europe, against such a land invasion. And so to invade, to land troops, then to scale the heights under the cover of, you know, of like air power ahead above you, and then parachuting going on and all sorts of, it is a massive undertaking that they did this, I believe, without the Nazis being aware of it, mobilizing the troops in England and preparing these Americans, British, and Canadians for this is remarkable, that God allowed it and blessed it. Also, this then, there's also, shortly before this, an invasion of Italy from under Patton, I think, maybe others, from North Africa, that then they make their way up and defeat one of the Axis. And so Italy falls before Germany does. There are several attempts, I believe, to take Hitler out personally. One of those we'll discover, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, a theologian I'm having you read some of his book on discipleship, he was involved with, and eventually lands him in jail, his involvement in this. There was a bomb that was meant to go off while Hitler was in a meeting with his staff, and it was in collusion with one of the staff members, but apparently somebody moved the bomb on the other side of a heavy oak table, so that went off. I think there was people killed, but Hitler was shielded by the heavy table and maybe had been injured, but survived it. Well, by the winter of 1944-45, the Nazis sustained their last assault. They pushed the Allies back in what's called the Battle of the Bulge. It created a bulge in the front line. The Allies had retreated, but then that was the last of the Nazi invasion or push. Then the Nazis keep losing. The Americans are horrified by each, you know, concentration camp they liberate. Eventually, Hitler takes his own life in an underground bunker, and there's a victory in Europe celebrated May 8th, 1945. That's called VE Day, Victory in Europe. Now, if you look on your notes, VE Day occurs before VJ Day. It's not like World War II is over. So you had three powers, Italy, Germany, and Japan. They fall in that order. Italy falls first, then Germany falls, but Japan is still holding out. And they're training their civilians for an invasion. And so it's a whole population mobilization. It's citizen soldiers. Everybody's going to be a soldier, apparently. And so it looks like it's going to be a very bloody affair, that this is not going to be a nation that's going to surrender. And of course, kamikaze pilots willing to commit suicide to drive their, you know, fly their plane into a ship. It's a people that accept death in that way. And so it looked bad. I believe on Iwo Jima, 22,000 Marines die or casualties on that island just to secure one island alone. Famously, it's that picture of the six Marines placing the U.S. flag on the top of Mount Suribachi, the highest point in the island, when the victory is close at hand, I believe. Island hopping is what it's called, securing island by island. And this way, then, you didn't have to have aircraft carriers where planes could land, refuel, and fly. You could actually have bases on these islands. The planes could only fly so far. One of them that dropped an atomic bomb barely made it back to Tinian, the island it flew from. It didn't even have enough gasoline to taxi back to the hangar. Well, the atomic bombs is credited with ending the war in the Pacific. There's Fat Boy and, Little Man, I think it's called. These two, that's the shape of them, basically, but developed in different techniques, different way, something you'll learn about in physics class. The Americans dropped flyers and warned the civilians of what was going to happen the next day, but who knows how many took, you know, careful note to flee, because many civilians died. America has been criticized for the dropping of bombs on civilian life. But more died, I believe, earlier in the year, in May of that year, when Tokyo was bombed with jellied gasoline. Napalm, I think it is. But jellied gasoline was dropped. I think 80,000 died when Tokyo was put on fire. And so this is some of the hard realities, again, of war. If you're going to have a nation that refuses to give up and to even arm all its citizens, then who's a soldier and who's not? And how do you handle this? And so Hansen mentions that it was the Allies that tried to control, you know, loss of civilian life and things like that, when the other side obviously has its racist tendencies and is oppressively treating lands that it invades. But no side is going to be without guilt. Who could say that all the motives of each person? It's just messy. But thankfully, I'm thankful that there is a VJ Day. They did then surrender after those two bombs were dropped. Who will ever know, other than God himself, how many lives were spared from an invasion? If one little island like Iwo Jima could take out thousands of lives, what would invading the mainland of Japan have been like? And so, thankfully, that was avoided at great cost to world history. But VJ Day was celebrated on August 15th. The official date is September 2nd, declared by the president, when the Japanese formally surrender on the decks of the USS Missouri to General Douglas MacArthur. The most destructive war in history to this point, $50 million, $13 billion in damages, whole countries decimated, atomic weaponry used for the first time. Jesus told us to not view these things as the end. This is not the end. There are worse things coming. These are the beginning of the birth pangs, when the world is going to someday, in the providence of God, through the coming of Jesus in the kingdom, give birth to a new heavens and a new earth. And this, what we see will be changed. This is our hope in Christ. When we read about things like this, and we should gain then a greater appreciation for those who have served and put themselves in harm's way in a just war cause, and honor them as such. But we should give greater honor to God, who has ordained such things for purposes known only to Him, and also for appointing His Son to be Prince of Peace, to teach the nations, as it says in Isaiah. And they will no longer teach themselves war, but will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. In other words, they will, it's a poetic image, they're going to take their dollars that they're pouring into military weaponry and turn it into agriculture. God would much rather have us be doing that. But in the meantime, as government is a necessary evil, which you'll see in public policy, so war is a necessary evil. It's part of what God has ordained in His government of the world. He uses it for good for His church. But let us fear Him, and let us place our hope not in the United Nations ultimately, or in rulers who, even if they have the best skill and best will ultimately die, but in Jesus Christ, who will never die, on whose shoulders is the government, Isaiah says, and of His government and of peace, of the increase of His government and of peace, there will be no end. The zeal of the Lord of armies shall accomplish it. Well, God bless you in reading on this war. May the Lord give you insights. I'd love to hear your thoughts on it. And so share them with me. And so we'll continue our look at modern Europe together. Thank you.